From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the fight against the Islamic State continues. We'll have the latest on the Ebola outbreak, including worries in the African diaspora. Plus, what's at stake for President Obama in the upcoming U.S. election? Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Explosions rocked the Syrian town of Kobani on Tuesday as the U.S.-led coalition carried out more airstrikes against Islamic State militants. Meantime, Iraqi Kurdish fighters have left Iraq and are headed to Kobani to help the Syrian Kurds fight the militants who've been trying to take control of the town for about a month. Also, Iraqi counterterrorism units patrolled the streets of Baghdad and carried out vehicle searches on Tuesday during an intensive security deployment to search for sleeper cells in the Sunni neighborhood of Al-Adl. Spokesman for the unit said they were chasing additional undercover cells and uncovering a large cell residing in hotels across the capital since Sunday. A high-level Iraqi security official recently established that there were 1,500 sleeper cell members in western Baghdad and a further 1,000 in the area on the outskirts of the capital. International monitors on Tuesday joined Syrian neighbors in calling for urgent assistance for the refugee crisis at an international conference on Iraq and Syria that was held in Berlin. German Foreign Minister Frank-Walter Steinmeier, whose country has led the way in Europe by taking in 70,000 refugees and giving nearly 650 million euros in aid, said international efforts to stop Islamic State murderous rampage would fail without a parallel solution, he said, for the growing refugee problem.
Deshalb können wir nur appellieren.
Steinmeier told the conference that Berlin would make at least 500 million euros available in humanitarian aid over the next 3 years, but it said it was time for other countries to start pulling their weight. He said everyone must join the debate and help the refugees. UN Refugee Chief Antonio Guterres called the situation the most dramatic humanitarian crisis the world has faced in a long time.
We ask the neighboring countries to keep their borders open. But we ask all countries in the world to keep their borders open to Syrian refugees. This is not only a responsibility of the countries of the region, this is a responsibility of the whole of the international community.
Several of the ministers addressed the urgent need to prevent unrest spilling across the region as refugees face a winter with severe food shortages. With the Islamic State militants posing a threat to an expanse of territory inside Syria that is home to about 5 million people, the region is facing a risk of expanding humanitarian disaster and added risk of rising social tensions as well as frictions. The Emir of Qatar will be visiting Britain this week amid accusations his country has financed extremist Islamist groups in Syria. Qatari officials deny any links with the groups and say they are actually working with the West to support the moderate opposition inside Syria. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
On the battlefields of Syria and Iraq, ISIS, or Islamic State, boasts modern weaponry. The group claims financial assets of tens of millions of dollars. Analysts say part of that wealth was looted in Iraq and Syria, but some Gulf states are charged with providing support for Islamist groups. Qatar has been accused of links with Al-Qaeda offshoot, the Al-Nusra Front, says Jane Kinnamont of Policy Institute Chatham House.
Quite a lot is speculation. By the nature of these activities, there isn't a great deal in the public domain, but there's clearly very serious worries about private financing from Qatar, but also from Kuwait and Saudi Arabia.
Speaking during a trip to Berlin last month, the Emir of Qatar, Sheikh bin Hamad Al Thani, strongly denied any links with extremist groups. The Emir said that Qatar will certainly not support terrorist or extremist organizations, be it in Syria or Iraq.
Hello, I'm John Cantley, and today we're in the city of Kobani.
On the eve of Sheikh bin Hamad Al Thani's visit to London, Islamic State released a video on the internet purportedly showing British hostage John Cantley forced to adopt the role of a mock television reporter in the besieged border town of Kobani. The emergence and brutality of Islamic State has forced Qatar and other Gulf states to backtrack, says Michael Stevens, head of the Royal United Services Institute in Qatar.
I think there is a certain amount of introspection going on in the Gulf to do with what groups they were funding and how they produced the funding, which then led to the creation of ISIS.
It is likely that moderate fighters, once supported by Qatar and other Sunni states, have been radicalised over that period, says Jane Kinnemont.
Once people, money and arms go into a complex civil war that's going on over several years, some of those people may not end up exactly where you thought they were in the first place.
Speaking in Egypt last week, US Treasury Secretary Jacob Lew pledged to take on the financial networks supporting extremist groups like ISIS.
We're in the United States determined to work with all of our allies in the region, not just on a military basis, but on a financial basis, to make sure that the resources do not continue to flow in.
Several Gulf states, including Qatar, have joined the US-led airstrikes on ISIS. Again, Michael Stevens.
There's been, you know, by the activity of this coalition, a sort of taking back of all these aggressive words which have been going between the West and the Middle East about who was funding who.
The Emir will meet the Queen and hold talks with Prime Minister David Cameron. Qatar has invested billions of dollars in Britain, and analysts say economic ties will be high on the agenda. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
And a quick programming announcement. Starting Sunday, that's November the 2nd at 22 hours Universal Time, VOA begins a new hour-long program. It will be in this time slot. We are calling it VOA Global. It will be hosted by my colleagues Jim Stevenson and Ira Melman, and will include segments on the latest world news, plus Asia features and reports on what's happening in the worlds of business, sports, as well as entertainment. Hope you'll join us for VOA Global beginning Sunday, November 2nd at 22 hours Universal Time. You'll be able to stream the program live at voanews.com under the Listen tab.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its
military. You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
For the landing on
civilians. And sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians.
With all that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World news on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
Here in Washington on Tuesday, President Obama spoke about U.S. efforts to help the people of West Africa who are fighting the Ebola outbreak.
We know that the best way to protect Americans ultimately is going to stop this outbreak at the source. And I just had the privilege of speaking with some of the men and women who are working to do just that. Our disaster assistance response team on the ground in West Africa. First and foremost, I thank them for their incredible dedication and compassion. These are the folks that, from the minute that we saw this Ebola outbreak growing larger than we had seen traditionally, were deployed, were on the ground, and were helping to coordinate the countries where the outbreak is happening to make sure that the response was effective. And it's typical of what America does best. When others are in trouble, when disease or disaster strikes, Americans help. And no other nation is doing as much to make sure that we contain and ultimately eliminate this outbreak than America. We deployed this DART team to West Africa back in early August. They're now the strategic and operational backbone of America's response. They've increased the number of Ebola treatment units and burial teams. They've expanded the pipeline of medical personnel and equipment and supplies. They've launched an aggressive education campaign in country. The bottom line is that they're doing what it takes to make sure that medical personnel and healthcare workers from all countries have what they need to get the job done. And the good news is that it's starting to have an impact. Based on the conversations that I had today with them, they're starting to see some progress in Liberia, and the infrastructure is beginning to get built out. That's thanks to the incredible work and dedication of folks from the United States who are leading the way in helping Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone. And it's critical that we maintain that leadership. The truth is that we're going to have to stay vigilant here at home until we stop the epidemic at its source. And for that, we're going to need to make sure that our doctors and our healthcare professionals here in the United States are properly trained and informed, and that they are coordinated if and when an Ebola case crops up here in the United States. But what's also critically important is making sure that all the talent, skill, compassion, professionalism, dedication, and experience of our folks here can be deployed to help those countries deal with this outbreak at the source. And that's why yesterday the CDC announced that we're going to have new monitoring and movement guidance that is sensible, based in science, and tailored to the unique circumstances of each health worker that may be returning from one of these countries after they have provided the kind of help that they need. In fact, tomorrow I'm going to have a chance to meet with doctors and public health workers who've already returned from fighting this disease in West Africa, or who are about to go, not only to say thank you to them and give them encouragement, but to make sure that we're getting input from them based on the science, based on the facts, based on experience, about how the battle to deal with Ebola is going and how our policies can support the incredible heroism that they are showing.
That's President Obama speaking late Tuesday here in Washington. Also Tuesday, the chairperson of the African Union called for African solidarity to overcome the Ebola outbreak, saying no country will be free and healthy if one country still faces the disease. Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma made the call at a meeting in Addis Ababa with officials of the UN, World Bank, African Development Bank, and the European Union Commission. She said upon returning from a visit to Ghana, Ivory Coast, Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone that her delegation was humbled by the efforts of the people and governments fighting the illness and its aftermath. World Health Organization is renewing its appeal to governments not to quarantine healthcare workers returning from the Ebola-stricken countries. Lisa Schlein reporting from the WHO in Geneva.
The World Health Organization says it is difficult to get across its simple message that people who do not display symptoms of Ebola are not contagious and cannot transmit the disease to others. WHO spokesman Tarek Jazarevich exhibits a bit of frustration when he repeats the UN Health Agency's recommendation advising against mandatory quarantine. He says health workers who go to West Africa to fight Ebola know how to monitor themselves for symptoms of the disease when they return home.
We desperately need international health workers, and we keep calling for health workers. They are really the key to this response. And these people should not be treated when coming home in a way that they would be stigmatized by the rest of the population.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has issued a statement in support of the health workers, reiterating the best way for any country to protect itself from the deadly Ebola virus is to stop the outbreak at its source in West Africa. The U.S. government has drawn up new health rules calling for returning medics to be monitored for symptoms of Ebola, not placed in quarantine. But the states of New York, New Jersey, and Illinois are standing by their decisions to quarantine health workers for the duration of the 21-day incubation period. Meanwhile, the Australian government says it will bar entry to visitors from the worst affected Ebola countries, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. Jazarevich tells VOA it is too soon to tell whether these restrictive measures will discourage healthcare workers from going to West Africa.
I talk quite often with people who are returning from the field, and it's just amazing how courageous these people are, and especially medical workers. So these people are really real heroes when they go in, spend their time, risk their health. And then this is why it's probably so difficult to accept the fact that they would be quarantined without no reason.
Ebola has infected more than 10,000 people and killed nearly 5,000 since December. Swissmedic, the Swiss regulatory authority for therapeutic products, has just announced that clinical trials of an experimental Ebola vaccine are to begin this week in the Swiss city of Lausanne. This trial, which is supported by WHO, follows ongoing vaccine trials in Mali, the United Kingdom, and the United States. Jazarevich says first results regarding the safety of the Ebola vaccine are expected in December. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
As President Obama mentioned earlier, Ebola screening is underway here in the U.S. He also mentioned the subject of quarantines for people traveling to and from West Africa. In the middle of all of this, many of the people in New York's African diaspora fear major economic repercussions here in the U.S. and in their homelands, as well as some social ostracism based on misinformation and panic about Ebola. VOA's Adam Phillips is in New York with our report.
For thousands of African immigrants living in America, a travel ban between the United States and Africa could prove catastrophic, says community leader Kofi Boateng, the Ghanaian-American director of the West Harlem Development Corporation.
Because it means they themselves are afraid or fear they may not be able to go back home to attend many important things such as funerals, attend to their businesses. A lot of the African diaspora are involved in business transactions back home, and vice versa. It also means that even government officials who have to come and oversee trade missions, diplomatic activities, visit the community, also can't come. It is fear.
Boateng says the Ebola scare has already affected livelihoods in Harlem. The district is dotted with braiding salons where women, mostly from West Africa, weave hair in the African style and apply hair extensions made from African hair. Boateng says these businesses have been losing customers at a growing rate over the past 2 months, even though many of the women working there have not visited their homelands for years. Similarly, many West African taxi drivers report being shunned by New Yorkers who fear that their cab interiors may transmit the Ebola virus. Neither fear is justified by the science. Yet despite repeated announcements from public health officials about how Ebola is and is not transmitted, Boateng says the information does not seem to be getting through.
So the Africans are afraid that when issues such as travel ban and misinformation about how you contract the disease take hold, then before they know it, their kids will be thrown out of school, they themselves will lose their jobs, their family members can't get visas.
Adding to the community's distress is the realization that traditional West African customs must be modified, at least for now. Treatment of the dead and dying is one arena, says Boateng, who is helping to organize local forums to inform his community, who may in turn educate loved ones back home. In America, over two-thirds of deaths occur in hospitals and other institutional settings. The bodies are typically transported to funeral homes, where they are washed and prepared for burial. In Africa, by contrast, most people die at home, and it's customary for family and community members to touch, kiss, wash, and bury the bodies themselves. But when a person has died of Ebola, contact with their body fluids puts mourners at high risk. Boateng and other leaders recommend that for now, that custom should change. They also warn about the extended handshaking that's deeply ingrained in African culture, especially at public events like weddings and funerals. These days, Boateng says, respectful eye contact and a wave must suffice. A publicity campaign in Nigeria advocated exactly that, and it seems to have changed people's behavior. Making these and other changes is a step forward, says Chika Onyani, editor and publisher of the widely read diaspora newspaper African Sun-Times. But he notes that battling the Ebola epidemic is no longer just Africa's problem.
Somebody died in Spain, somebody died in Germany, and somebody died in the U.S., It's a worldwide problem now. So let us all unite. Let's not stigmatize a group of people for what is happening. Let us all work together.
Indications of progress are mixed. On Friday, two Bronx schoolboys from Senegal were beaten up by fellow students yelling, Ebola, While downtown, Manhattan's Bellevue Hospital's isolation ward admitted New York City's first Ebola patient. The United Nations reports that an international fund it has set up to fight Ebola has collected just under half of its $1 billion goal. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays on the Voice of America.
Americans head to the polls next Tuesday, and the results could have a major impact on President Obama's final 2 years in office. Observers are saying he has a lot riding on the voting results, and Republicans have tried to make him the central issue in this year's campaign. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone is following the story.
In one sense, the 2014 midterm election is Barack Obama's final campaign, one last chance to win over voters and help Democrats hold their majority in the Senate.
Now, I'm not on the ballot this fall. Michelle's pretty happy about that. But make no mistake, these policies are on the ballot. Every single one of them.
Republicans have been eager to make the president a focal point of their national campaign with a blitz of last-minute TV ads.
November 4th, Obama's policies are on the ballot. Vote to keep terrorists off U.S. soil. Vote Republican.
Republican candidates are also targeting the president, including North Carolina Senate contender Tom Tillis, who's running for a seat held by Democrat Kay Hagan.
If you want the same failed policies of President Obama, you'd vote for Kay Hagan.
Senator Hagan fired back during a recent debate.
Speaker Tillis wants to make this race about the president. This race is about who is going to represent North Carolina.
The president's low public approval ratings are helping Republicans and have caused many Democrats to keep their distance from Mr. Obama, says analyst John Fortier of the Bipartisan Policy Center.
One, midterm elections tend to go against the president no matter what. Two, the president isn't doing so well in public opinion polls. He's at about 40 to 42% of people thinking he's doing a good job.
And that means many voters will see the midterm elections as a referendum on the president, says Carlin Bowman, a public opinion analyst with the American Enterprise Institute.
He won't be on the ballot, of course, and usually around 6 in 10 people tell the pollsters that he won't be a factor in their vote. Of the remainder, however, more people describe their vote as a vote against the president than for him.
Concerns about the spread of Ebola, the rise of the Islamic State in the Middle East, and the domestic economy are helping Republicans as the election draws near, says conservative analyst Michael Barone.
We're basically seeing, on the one hand, basic issues of the economy, foreign policy, the world in disarray, are hurting Democrats and at least temporarily helping Republicans. In the longer term, past the election, of course, Republicans are going to have to offer something different.
Most experts believe Republicans are likely to win a majority in the Senate in November, setting up Republican control of both the Senate and House of Representatives for the final 2 years of the Obama presidency. Henry Olson monitors U.S. politics for the Ethics and Public Policy Center.
I would say that it looks like the Senate is likely to end up in Republican hands. The question would be the degree of the majority and exactly which people are going to be coming.
Republicans need a net gain of 6 seats now held by Democrats to win an outright majority in the Senate. And the polls show Republicans leading in many of the key Senate races around the country in the final days of the campaign. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
And a bit of U.S. stock market news. The Dow jumped above 17,000 on Tuesday following a strong report on U.S. consumer confidence. Dow Jones Industrial Average up 1.12% to 17,005, its first close above 17,000 since October the 3rd. S&P 500 gained 1.19% to 1985. The NASDAQ Composite Index up 1.75% to 4564. Confidence Board said that America's Confidence Index leaped to 94.5 in October from 89 in September. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Marty Curcius, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Wednesday.
This is Today in History. On October 29, 1682, William Penn arrived in the British American colony that bore his name, Pennsylvania. On this day in 1858, the first store opened in the small town that would later become Denver, Colorado. The store served miners flocking to strike it rich during the area's gold rush. The 29th of October was called Black Tuesday in 1929. It was the day of the great crash, the frenzied, panic-fueled trading of stocks as investors struggled desperately to avoid financial ruin. When the dust settled, nearly 12% of the market's value had been wiped out, contributing to the nation's descent into the Great Depression. On this day in 1956, Israeli armed forces pushed into Egypt toward the Suez Canal. The attack followed a decision by Egyptian President Gamal Abdel Nasser to nationalize the canal. Britain and France sided with the Israelis, but were forced to back down due to opposition from the United States and the Soviet Union. On this day in 1923, Turkey formally became a republic after the dissolution of the Ottoman Empire. Mustafa Kemal, later known as Ataturk, or Father of the Turks, led the founding of the republic. In 1960, young Cassius Clay, who later took the name Muhammad Ali, won his first professional fight in Louisville, Kentucky. In 2004, European leaders signed the European Union's first constitution. In 2008, Delta Airlines merged with Northwest Airlines, creating the world's largest airline and reducing the number of U.S. legacy carriers to five. I'm Dave DeForest with Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In a major address in Washington concerning the P5+1 nuclear negotiations with Iran, U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs Wendy Sherman, America's lead nuclear negotiator, spoke of the possibility of success and the remaining challenges in reaching a comprehensive accord involving Iran's nuclear program.
We have made impressive progress on issues that originally seemed intractable. We have cleared up misunderstandings and held exhaustive discussions on every element of a possible text.
Yet, Undersecretary Sherman said, difficult issues remain, which must be worked out with a sense of urgency and purpose.
Our group has proposed to Iran a number of ideas that are equitable, enforceable, and consistent with Tehran's expressed desire for a viable civilian nuclear program, and that take into account that country's scientific know-how and economic needs.
The international community will decide to suspend and lift sanctions on Iran, Undersecretary Sherman said, only if and when Iran takes convincing and verifiable steps to show that its nuclear program is and will remain exclusively and entirely peaceful.
That is a reasonable standard that Iran can readily meet. It is the standard that Iran must meet. And it is the key to ending Iran's international isolation.
A comprehensive nuclear accord, Undersecretary Sherman stressed, would result in extraordinary benefits, including making possible greater prosperity for the Iranian people, protecting U.S. allies from a new and dangerous threat, lessening the incentive for a regional nuclear arms race, thereby strengthening the international nuclear nonproliferation regime, and demonstrating the value of clear-eyed diplomacy that can reach win-win solutions achievable in no other way. Undersecretary Sherman acknowledged that a forest of distrust exists between Iran and the United States, and emphasized that while the U.S. will not accept any arrangement that it cannot verify, it will also not make any promises it can't keep. Just as we will demand good faith, she said, so will we demonstrate good faith. We hope Iran will make the right choice, said Undersecretary Sherman. We are ready to do so. This is the time to finish the job.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.